Hollow sounding, isn't it? Good evening. This is a continuation of the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. Just for those of you who may be here on the Hayden bill related to what did we call it? It was the Standards of Care Act. The conversations have been continuing, and it is the request of the author that we keep it on the table until Wednesday. So if people are here for that bill, and only that bill, we will not be taking it up this evening. So with that, we can begin with Senate file. Is Senator Hoffman here? But is Senator Hayden still here? We may not be taking anything up tonight, huh? Both of these are... Madam Chair, we don't have our authors here for our bills.
Oh, I thought it was on this one. I guess not. Senator Hayden.
He was Hoffman. Just here. Senator Hoffman is coming, I'm certain.
I'll just say I could start it.
Pardon?
I was going to say I could start it.
You could start them.
I'm not a co-author.
Yeah. Oh. Can always be added later.
Okay.
Is that too fast?
We're going to get them. We're going to get them here.
Two similar bills as well, DHS's bill and the Advocate Center.
That's the one I'm on. Okay, so I am on one of them.
Yeah, but not this one.
Not this one, sorry. Thank you, Dave. Where are they? Chelsea. Say thank you.
Senator Hayden, are you ready to begin? Looks like it. Good evening, Senator Hayden. I have announced that the earlier bill, Senate File 1340, it will remain on the table until 471 will remain on the table till this coming Wednesday.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And thanks for those who have been working awfully hard trying to find agreement on that bill.
Great. And so we'll begin with Senate File 1340.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senate File 1340, I think there should be an author's amendment. Are two there? One or two?
Do we have it in our packets, or is it distributed? Need to be distributed?
It is the A1 amendment.
It's in the packet.
Okay.
This is an author's amendment?
Yes, this is an author's amendment.
Senator Hayden offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I have the agency's data practice, Department of Human Services data practice, in what you amended in with the background, the Office of Inspector General's bill. I'm going to let my testifiers kind of take over for there. I had been doing a little running around, Madam Chair, trying to put some of this together. So I'm going to let these guys get started.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself and who you represent?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Laura Plummer-Zerust with the Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General Licensing Division. And this is the Office of Inspector General Policy Bill. This bill amends a number of different statutes, including the Data Practices Act, the Human Services Licensing Act, the Human Services Background Studies Act is part of the amendment. It also contains fraud, abuse, and investigation provisions, a chemical health provision. So I will begin with the data practices provisions and first turn it over to my colleague who has the first section.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Vicki Kunerth with the Office of Inspector General, and I'm responsible for the Investigations Division. In Article 1, Section 1, what this does is modify the investigations section in the Data Practices Act. A current law allows us to disclose the fact of investigations while they are active. We have become aware that in a number of cases, such disclosure during an active investigation can actually damage, destroy, and frankly disrupt the investigation. Sometimes we have just started surveillance. Sometimes we find that a case is very complex and worthy of further criminal investigation. And if the focus of that investigation knows of our investigation, sometimes it damages it. So we're asking for a constraint on that public so that if the commissioner determines that it would compromise the investigation, we would not make that public.
Then the second data practices provision, Laura Plummer's arrest again, is related to amending the licensing data, and this does three things. First of all, it makes the general nature of matter under investigation when a temporary immediate suspension order is issued, makes just that general nature public data. Right now, when we issue temporary immediate suspensions, they're under investigation for the most part, and nothing about that is public at all. So this would be just the nature. It also makes public the existence of settlement negotiations. When a sanction matter is under settlement discussions, sometimes those can be protracted, and not even the existence that settlement discussions are going on is public. So that would make that public. And then lastly, right now when we have an applicant or a license holder who's found responsible for maltreatment or disqualified, and then we issue a licensing sanction, like a revocation, that is public data. We are adding to that if it's a controlling individual that is found responsible for that maltreatment or disqualification, and that then forms the basis for a sanction, will also be public data. So those are the data practices provisions in our bill.
Perhaps you could, besides saying what's in the bill, can you say what problem these are fixing, or what is the issue that result in making the nature of the existence of a settlement negotiation occurring, et cetera? Why the change, and what is it that's being fixed with these changes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. What is at issue is, for example, in the settlement discussions, we've had cases where, and there's been, say, a lot of immediate attention on a case, and parents have called inquiring, what's going on with the case? Why is it taking so long? And we were not able to say that there were settlement discussions going on. So it's really about making more information public about the status of a case, for example.
So is it the case that there may be a complaint or an investigation going on, someone's initiated a process, and they don't get any feedback as to what's happening, so they're uncertain if anything is happening at all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. In this case, there would have been a licensing sanction issued, but then what's going on with it? So, yes, that is the case.
Thank you. If you would, as you're talking about the changes, articulate what it is that is being fixed or being improved as a result of the change, that'd be helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, then I'll go on to Article 2 of the bill, which contains the Licensing Act provisions, and I'll try to group those together for you into kind of categories of similar type of amendments, and we'll address why they're necessary. So Articles 1, 12, 13, 14, and 15, address some child care provisions that are clarification of basis. And you may know there are other child care initiatives this session in our budget bill. These are those that are just related to policy and are primarily clarification. And what they relate to, first of all, is there's two that relate to CPR training for child care providers. One is for licensed and one is for legal non-licensed. And specifying that CPR, when the provider serves infants, must be specific to infants. In other words, the training must address infants because, as we know, CPR for adults would be different than infants. So that's two of them. The other child care provisions deal with license holder documentation about crib inspection and compliance with federal crib inspection standards and crib standards overall. And so these two amendments are necessary to comport to federal regulations in this area. And then the other relates to clarifying that family child care regulations, the rule standards and statutory standards, apply to the provision of care to, say, the license holder's own children when they're under the applicable age group, say 10 or under, and they're in the home during the hours of care. An example would be supervision and capacity, that those types of the children are counted in the capacity. And this was necessary because this issue came up, questioning whether do the standards apply or not. And in some cases it was clear, but it wasn't clear with respect to all standards. So those are really most of the child care related ones in this bill. Other changes, there are two that relate to controlling individuals, Section 2 and Section 11. Section 2 clarifies the definition of a controlling individual, and controlling individuals are important to us in licensing in terms of who is accountable for the program, who's the applicant, accountability, and it also is important in the program integrity area in terms of accountability for public funds. And so Section 2 clarifies the definition, and that is necessary to clarify that if you have an employee who doesn't have that ownership or managerial responsibility for the program overall, but is the director of a specific site, they are not considered a controlling individual for these purposes. And then Section 11 has to do with an application. And when we have an application where an individual identified as a controlling individual, the application is denied. If they are a party to a subsequent application, then that does not what that means is that application is denied too, because there's a 2-year prohibition from reapplication if you've had a license application denied. Then there are a couple, well, I'll highlight a few provisions that regarding applicants. Last session, Section 3, last session we requested the state taxpayer ID. And this session, we are adding a federal tax ID if the individual has employees, and for facility-type models that have employees, to include their federal tax ID, and also to request that they provide us with their all registered business names with the Secretary of State and any assumed names. And that, again, is important for identifying who is accountable in these programs. Section 6 and 7 deal with sanctions. And so I'll talk about the amendments that are relevant here, too. Section 6 is related to conditional licenses. And this amendment and the author's amendment related to this one are clarifying that a conditional license may also be based on a situation in which there is an individual that may have been living in the home at the time or may have had access but, say, no longer lives in the home. And while this provision clearly states that a revocation could be issued, in some of those situations, a revocation is not warranted. It would not be sustained upon appeal. And this followed a Court of Appeals decision which questioned our authority to issue a conditional license on that basis. So we need to specify in the law that, yes, indeed, a conditional license may be issued in such situations. And that's really to put in place conditions that allow the license holder to continue to operate, but make it clear that that disqualified individual cannot be in the home when services are provided. And that is part of the author's amendment as well. And then the other sanction piece. Yeah,
excuse me, and if that person were there, they would not receive the license. Is that the situation? The condition has changed that the affiliated person for which a license, whose existence there creates a phenomenon in which a license would not be issued. If that person is gone, it could be issued, but you have to put the conditions to make sure that that remains in place.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, exactly right. And if it had been revoked, you know, before, that would be the case too. Then the other one relates to a temporary immediate suspension. A temporary immediate suspension is the sanction, the most serious sanction we issue. And this amendment and the author's amendment provide that when we have already issued a revocation, sometimes, again, these programs that are under order revocation have their due process right to appeal. They may continue operating and may continue to have violations that may pose a risk of harm. So this is making it clear that if indeed that is the case, there are additional new violations that we could then issue a temporary immediate suspension order, taking their license away prior to the hearing. Again, they're afforded due process in that case. Then The remaining provisions in this article really relate to sections 8, 9, and 10, really relate to timeline and scope of contested case hearing. And in particular, section 9 is establishing timelines for contested case hearings on sanctions. Right now in the statute, there's timelines for temporary immediate suspension hearings. They get an expedited hearing, but there are not timelines for other types of hearings. And this is addressing a concern. Again, it kind of relates to what I indicated before about what's going on, what's taking so long, public inquiring about that. So this establishes timelines for that to occur. The author's amendment to this, based on input we received, is that we need to, however, allow for an exception to these timelines in cases where there may be a pending criminal or juvenile matter, and typically then matters are put on hold pending the outcome resolution of those other pending matters. And then sections 18 through 24, and actually the repealer, are technical in nature. They relate to last session, as you may recall, home and community-based service standards, what were considered to be the first phase of those, were passed but not implemented because the legislature instructed the department to develop a cost recovery methodology in order to implement those fees. So then what occurred is that the current law, what is referred to as 245B standards that govern some of these services, there were amendments passed that resulted in kind of a limbo period, a short period of some providers having to change some protocols and then having to turn around and change them again when the new 245D passes. So based on provider input, too, the department agreed that, no, this session we're going forward with a full home and community-based service standards package, making these unnecessary. So that concludes the Licensing Act provisions in Article 2. There are no questions.
Are there any questions on Article 2?
Madam Chair and members, Article 3 is financial fraud and abuse investigation provisions. In Subdivision 1 and 4 would grant us the authority to have the option of using unmarked cars for conducting investigations. Specifically, Subdivision 1 covers the plates, and Subdivision 4 covers the sides of the car. This is for our investigators, both in central office as well as our county investigators that we support through grants. This request came from the counties because they were not specifically authorized to use unmarked cars, and in some counties they couldn't do it. And having unmarked cars, both the plates and the side, is important to protect our surveillance activity, but also the investigator. They're not always welcome in all neighborhoods. The next two subdivisions, 2 and 3, deal with data access from two other state agencies, Department of Public Safety, and once in Subdivision 2 and in Subdivision 3, it's for deed. And in both cases, these two state agencies are comfortable with our language. In Subdivision 2, this language relates to the facial recognition project that between the Department of Public Safety and DHS that was passed last session. Starting this coming summer, DPS will be sending us data from driver's licenses they canceled where they identified the same face on multiple driver's licenses with different names. Now, they use special software to identify the same face, multiple driver's licenses with differing names. A large majority turned out to be legitimate variations of people getting married, close relatives, hair changes, glasses changes, all kinds of legitimate reasons. But what they have come down to is probably around 15 instances where they can't account for a legitimate reason where it appears that the same face is on a license with different names. And according to the statute that passed last session, we will proceed with our investigations to determine whether that person has a public benefit account and whether that is legitimate and it's a real person, and is there something else going on. What this language does is specifically make sure that the DPS can give us the photo as well as the demographic data that they plan to give us on these driver's licenses. In Subdivision 3, this language expands our access to the wage data in deed so that we can conduct our investigation of providers as well as recipients. We've been aware of cases where sometimes employees have been given false pay stubs and for that reason use that to get authorization for child care assistance. And then when we confirm that employment status by looking at the actual wage detail for that provider, we find it doesn't sync up and that there's evidence of collusion between the employee and the employer. And so that's why I'm making sure we are authorized to investigate the providers as well as the recipients. And that's end of Article 3.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Article 4 contains one amendment, and that relates to what are referred to as chemical dependency treatment program rate enhancement standards. And these were passed last session, and licensing, as part of their monitoring functions, also monitors for these rate enhancement standards. And for example, a chemical dependency program that is serving individuals with co-occurring conditions, say mental health and chemical health needs. Also, chemical health programs that are serving children, parents with children in the program. And so this specific provision is a documentation fix to just clean up and clarify documentation requirements related to those programs that serve children in the chemical health program. And that concludes Article 4.
Concludes the presentation on the bill. Okay, thank you very much. Anything further, Senator Hayden, on Senate File 1340?
Madam Chair, I think we also need to go through the author's amendment, and then I think we have a little more testimony.
And who will be testifying?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zarust again. We did go through the author's amendments related to the Licensing Act, but not background studies. And what this author's amendment is doing is adding in the background studies provisions into the bill in front of us. So Chapter 245C amendments. So I will highlight those as well for you. And Chapter 245C is the law that governs background studies conducted by the Department of Human Services for a wide array of subjects. And the first section changes the timeline for submission of another study. When people are absent from work, last session that timeline was changed from 45 to 90 days to have another study. And what some providers, particularly Head Start providers, told us during the interim was that was not enough. There was discussion last session about should it be 90, should it be 120, should it be 180, and 90 was landed on last session. And so this is moving that up to 120 days after an absence from work. And then this provision is also clarifying that studies must be submitted under NetStudy, which is our electronic means of submitting studies, and it's also requiring that studies have to be initiated when an individual undergoes a legal name change. Then sections 2 through 7 do a number of clarifying pieces that are fairly technical in nature, so I'll just highlight those, and if there's any questions, of course, let me know. But those pertain to areas such as the information provided to the department for us to conduct studies, reconsideration timelines, and reconsideration is that first level of due process. The status of a disqualified individual following that reconsideration if they have a hearing right. So those are clarifications that were needed because questions came
up. Could you identify where you are on the I'm not following exactly
yes.
where you're at.
Those I was referring to sections 2 through 7 of the author's amendment. Should make sure that.
On what page are you?
That would be, Madam Chair, members of the committee, page 6, starting at line 14, is section 2, and then going through That's Section 7 on page 9. So I grouped those together as clarification in nature based on the areas that I identified. But, Madam Chair, I'm happy to go into more detail in each of those if the committee wishes. Otherwise, I'll continue with the rest of the author's amendment. And the remaining sections 9.
Would you hold just a minute? We're just looking at on page 7, C, in which you're describing providing a set of classifiable fingerprints. Is that... That's substantially different than just a technical change, isn't it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is what's done now. It's just making it clear in this list of what information may be collected. So the standard for obtaining fingerprints is when there is reasonable cause. That's defined in statute. So this is to make it clear that when their identity is uncertain, then they would have to provide fingerprints. There's a reasonable cause standard in statute right now for obtaining fingerprints.
Continue.
Chair.
This will be going. Where does this go next? Judiciary. Okay.
Sections 9 through 12, and again, I'll group these, mainly apply to contested case and fair hearing clarifications in terms of scope and what is conclusive. So what these provisions do is clarify for a matter to be included in the scope of the hearing, and what I'm talking about is, say, contested case hearing that may be related to a sanction, like a revocation. And it also includes other matters, or may include other matters, such as the maltreatment determination of disqualification I testified about earlier in the licensing area. And in order for these to be included in the scope of the hearing, for one thing, that the request has to be timely. So some of these relate to timeliness. And then the others relate to conclusiveness. And conclusiveness really relates to when a matter has, there has been a right to request an appeal of a matter and that right was not exercised previously, then it's conclusive. And this amends the background studies provisions, but also the fair hearing provision. So there's the same amendments in different statutes is really what we're doing here to make them conform. But they're all about scope and conclusiveness of a contested case hearing, which is the right hearing right that our license holders receive when there's a sanction issued. Madam Chair, or members, any questions?
It doesn't appear that there are any questions at this time. Does that conclude your... Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you, yes.
Senator Hayden.
Well, Madam Chair, as you can see, this is a good bill. The department has done a very good job and a very thorough. So with that being said, Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1340 as amended.
Senator Hayden renews his motion to pass Senate File 1340 and have it referred to Judiciary as amended. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Another three.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Hello. Good evening, Senator Hoffman. You're here on Senate File 1315.
I am, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me be here in front of you to talk about disability waivers rate systems, DWRS. Let's add another acronym to the world that we live in. And with me, Madam Chair and members, you're going to hear from Alex Bartolik, who's with the Department of Human Services. I said that right, didn't I? I always, like, for years. And then Lynn Noren from RISE. And so what I wanted to be able to do, Madam Chair, is for this evening is to be able to recommend that 1315 be passed and be referred to Health and Human Services Finance Committee. And what you'll hear tonight is not only Senate File 1315, but little bits of Senate File 1400, which has already been referred to the Finance Committee. And what you have is two bills that are going to be presented in the future that get to this rate restructuring, this rate modification that we have to do. And I'll explain a little bit more in detail, and you'll hear about that as we move forward. So just to give some background to the committee is in 2007, the Centers for Medicare and Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, informed Minnesota that our state's disability waivers were out of compliance with the federal requirements for uniform rate determination methods and standards. So in response, this disability waivers rate system initiative was created, and its hope was to restore compliance with the federal requirements and allow renewal of the Minnesota disability waivers. Because here's the caveat, failure to comply with what CMS wants could jeopardize the supports and services to 37,000 people in the state of Minnesota and approximately about $815 million in federal finance participation. So it's important that we have a transparent and a collaborative process moving forward to do what's best for the citizens and folks within Minnesota. So real quickly, the objective of DWRS is to create a statewide rate setting methodology for the waivered services, and there are four. Number one is we want it to be transparent, fair, consistent across the state, yet needs to capture the individualized nature of services. That's the unique and individualized needs of the individuals that we're doing services for. Number two, to promote quality and participant choice. Number three, we must meet federal requirements for the administration of the waiver programs. And finally, we want to establish rates based on a uniform process for structuring component values for services. There are some areas where there is some disagreement among stakeholders and including folks here today, but I need to tell you that this is a collaborative and very transparent process, and we've got an agreement from folks to work through this process so that we can come with a win-win or a final product that folks can agree upon by April 19th. Both bills create a new payment system. Now, each one is different, but that's what brings us here tonight, Madam Chair and committee members. And so with me is first Alex Bartolik, who is are you division? What is your title? Assistant? I always want to call her assistant commissioner, but division director from the Department of Human Services. So, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It's Director of Disability Service, DHS. Is that correct? And
yes, Madam Chair.
So with that, Ms. Bartolik, you will be going through the language of the bill that is in front of us.
Correct.
And then if I understand Senator Hoffman, that there are elements of what is being proposed here that are still in conversation, dealt with in a little different way in another bill, and that conversation is going to be continuing. But I don't know if you plan to highlight that as you go through the bill, where we might be having further conversation that might be helpful to the committee and articulate sort of a general sense of what it is we're trying to accomplish in this bill and then how you might be modifying it. That'd be very helpful.
Okay. Madam Chair, my name is Alex Bartolik, and I am with the Department of Human Services, the Director of Disability Services. And Senate File 1315, as Senator Hoffman said, is about our disability services, our disability waiver services. And home and community-based services in Minnesota have been very successful. They've been supporting people to live in the community. for decades now, and it really has been the means that we have used to deinstitutionalize, to close our large state hospitals, to help many community providers transition to supporting people in the community. And right now, about 94% of people with disabilities do live in the community instead of a nursing home or another institutional setting. These services have been key to that. We have four disability waiver programs. We have one for people with developmental disabilities. We have one for people with brain injury. We have one for people with physical disabilities and often serving people with a mental illness who would need a nursing facility level of care. We also have one for people who are at risk of a hospital level of care. And so when we talk about this rate setting, it's around services in those four programs, which do serve over $37,000 with a total of over $1.7 billion of services in 2012. Now, the term waiver is really just referring to when this program first started, it was allowing states to waive certain Medicaid regulations that were in place where around nursing facility payments and saying, you know what, states, you can design the services that you want, and we'll come up with a plan to approve them as long as the plan shows how you're going to meet people's health and safety needs, how you're going to assure that their service needs are met, making sure that you are not spending any more on these services than you otherwise would for institutional care, and also as long as we define what services we're going to provide and provider standards. So they waive those, and that's where the name these waiver services have started. We are a county-administered system. That means that counties have administered these programs as well as others. For the waiver programs, this has meant since they started in the early 80s, counties established contracts with providers. They would develop services. In many cases, they recruited new providers. They would write contracts, and they were responsible for assuring that the standards of care that the providers were doing was appropriate for each person. They were also responsible to negotiate rates and to have those rates as part of the county contract. Now, the rates not only vary between counties, but they have also varied over time or varied depending on the circumstances. So we've had a pretty diverse set of responses to establishing rates. And as Senator Hoffman said, in 2007, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services raised questions about how we were using county contracts and ultimately said that we were in violation of federal law. They said we couldn't continue to have the contracts because we were, in essence, limiting people's right to choose from a qualified provider. By having contracts, we were also preventing qualified providers from being able to serve people across the state where they chose to do business. In order to eliminate county contracts, we would then have to have consistent provider enrollment processes with statewide standards for providers and oversight of those standards by the Department of Human Services, rather than having counties have such a critical role. And we had to establish uniform rate-setting processes and document the basis of the rates that were paid. So we were forced to enter into a corrective action plan in order to eliminate the contracts, set up new standards, and to do the rates. And we have been working towards that corrective action plan, which right now has an implementation date of 2014. Now, prior to the corrective action plan, there had been work in Minnesota around rates. There was recognition that the variation in rates for similar services was not helpful to providers who were negotiating different rates in different counties, and it wasn't helpful for people who increasingly wanted more choices and controls over their services. So in 2009, the legislature did authorize the development of this rate system for the disability waivers. And I just want to make it clear, this does not pertain to services that are authorized through the elderly waiver. There were different ways of managing rates and costs in those programs. And last year, we did have two different bills at very different focuses, and the 2012 legislature required us to work with our stakeholders in order to come forward with doing some research and final details for implementation. And this is what we are bringing forward today. Now, when we talk about methodologies to establish payment rates, we're talking about how to identify what it takes for a provider to deliver a service and establishing a payment that will reasonably accommodate those factors. This does not dictate how a provider manages a business. doesn't dictate what wages they pay to certain people, doesn't dictate what kind of training they have to do. They have the authority to establish wages and benefits and the use of full-time versus part-time. We're just simply using a set of factors to determine a rate. Research was done during this entire process, and especially over the last year, to figure out what's the appropriate value for the different costs that providers have while still giving them the flexibility to manage their business. Some of the things that we looked at included labor costs. What were different wages that might have to be paid, and how do we account for payroll taxes and unemployment and vacation and sick time and training time? There were also costs that had to be taken into account that relate to supervision and staff management and how to make sure that there's the right programming and support that goes on for individual clients. There's general overhead costs that providers have, and also costs related to, for example, a client isn't there when you show up. You still had to pay for a staff person to go. Or you're having a shared staffing ratio and somebody goes home to visit their parents and they're not there on a day. We wanted to make sure that we were figuring out some strategies to manage that. We also looked at costs to cover transportation when it's part of the service. So one example, we looked at the Minnesota Bureau of Labor Statistics as a source to identify wages for similar services. And our stakeholder advisory group developed composites of job classes, saying, you know what, when we think about this service, it really takes 20% from here, 40% from here to create what we really provide, because not one job class fits. And we adopted those recommendations as we go forward. The methodologies also need to be responsive to individual needs of people. So, for example, there's a provision in shared staffing to increase the staffing, to have more people on duty if you need it to manage the needs of some people, or to buy more units of service where you need to do to manage this. So over this past year, stakeholders have invested thousands of hours into this process. They've worked in multiple work groups and advisory groups and really dug into the details behind this. And some of the research questions we had to address is how can we group services into four service areas? And how do we make sure that the rates that we are establishing through this process within those service areas are done in such a way that spending under the new process is equivalent to what we were projecting to have spent, so that we don't create some issues there. The group was also responsible for... I was going to get to that in my next one, but you do have a one-page handout. And so this one does do a summary, and it shows in the one-page handout. So we'll be Vanna and we'll go through that. But there are some things that talk about the components of what goes into a formula, and I'll come back to this in a moment. We needed to provide to you recommendations for the final values under the recommendations, and we also needed to research specific topics. And some of these topics were what was going to be a data-driven way of establishing labor costs, so that in the future, instead of trying to decide are they up or down, we can look at an objective basis of saying, yes, this is where some of the costs have gone up, which is one reason why we use the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Another research factor that people spent a lot of time in is trying to understand if there were geographic differences in the cost of service. This is an example of an area there wasn't agreement. A lot of passion, a lot of very strong feelings on both sides of it. And people looked at all kinds of sources of information from economic development and a lot of different studies that were done. And in the end, there was not a recommendation that was agreed upon. So right now, there isn't a value for geographic differences. That's an area that we think we need to continue looking for. So throughout this process of developing the methodology, stakeholders were involved in the analysis, the development of recommendations and the language. We had counties and lead agencies such as health plans and tribes work with providers to try to provide data so we could start doing an analysis. We've used different tools to try to simulate what would be the effect if we increase wages, if we do this with benefits. So we've tried to use a number of tools during our research. In the end, we want a system, in addition to the very formal goals we've adopted, but we want something that will reflect participant needs. We want a system that recognizes reasonable and necessary costs of providers in doing business. We want to provide fiscal stability for providers as well as for the state. We need a way of facilitating regular updates so that we don't keep re-going through this process, but we have a way of saying, here's some objective information to use to look at that. And we also wanted to increase the transparency. So in Senate File 1315, you are seeing the conclusion of a great deal of work that's brought us here. And with the one-pager, on the bottom of the one-pager, is just the language goes through a series of formulas. And this just tries to put in a picture how this formula goes through. So what things we will look at, some wage costs, how do we calculate in what program costs are. And it does matter where in the formula certain factors get accounted for in the formula. So this is just a short summary of some of the components that go into the methodology. It also, on the back side, has these four little blue areas. This talks about the four different service groups, the buckets. And so we wanted to look for different service categories, different groupings of services that had similarities. And as we looked at that, we looked at residential, where you have shared staffing. You may have different levels of staffing, but you have several people who are living together, and we need to be looking at the cost of providing services to that group of people. So foster care, supported living services are examples of residential shared staffing. I do want to say that foster care is an example of a service that can be paid for in a lot of different ways. And I know there's been some confusion, but we're talking about foster care that's paid for through the disability waivers in this context. There are actually some foster care providers who don't receive any waiver payments. They're paid for it either through child welfare, group residential housing, and it's a minimal payment around that. We're not talking about those folks. Day services is another service cluster. This includes day training and habilitation, adult daycare, and it lists which services. Unit-based with programming, this is talking about a type of service where I'm going to purchase a 15-minute unit, for example, to get some help, and it's a one-on-one, and I want to get some very specific help. So examples of that are independent living skills or supported employment. We need to have people that are familiar with the service. They can be doing an assessment. They can be training and helping the person gain new skills. We have unit-based without programming. Again, it's a service I'm buying to help me, but it might be night supervision or companion care, where we don't need the staff person to have the same level of skills and training that others would have. The language also establishes the procedures for moderating provider rate changes to no more than 1% a year, whether it's up or down, for a 3-year period. This will give us some time both to answer some of the questions we still have, but also to allow everyone to understand the implications of this. There may be some changes in business model, but it's a 3-year period to moderate those changes. The legislation does have a start date beginning January 1st, 2014. This is a difference with the other bill, which recommends passing language and not implementing it till 2016. Now, CMS has continued to ask for regular updates for us on what are we doing to assure that we will be ready to implement these changes on 2014. From their perspective, they raised it with us in 2007. We finally reached a corrective action plan in 2008. We gave them legislation in 2009. They're wanting to see it implemented. And so they are looking for progress to be that we pass legislation this year that will implement a 2014 start date. We have spoken with them today to let them know that there is a bill with a different timeline, so we will let you know what we hear from them on that. But to know that from us, we've been told we have to implement by 2014, and what they have done is they have not allowed any renewals of any of our waiver plans until we are ready to implement. So our DD waiver expired in July of 2012. We've just been working on extensions. Our CAC waiver will not be approved. They're waiting to see if this happens, so that's just going on an extension. So that's part of the dynamics and the context for this. The bill establishes a procedure to apply this bucket neutrality adjustment in service areas. So when we look at the spending for residential services or day services or unit services, when we apply this formula across the whole waiver, we come out pretty cost neutral across the whole thing. But there are differences in some of these service areas. So because we have The legislation requires us to assure that the spending in a service area will be the same as what it was projected to be without this language. We have a factor to either raise it or lower it in order to help mitigate that change. It also establishes a procedure for updating or changing payment methodologies. This is another area of change. We have proposed coming back to the legislature on two-year cycles, and then ultimately, hopefully after a number of years, being able to go to four-year cycles to provide information about changes in labor costs or the basis of these other factors for you to make a decision about what to do, whether to increase the rates. And the coalition would like to see, and Lynn will talk more about that, but regular updates, that there are updates on a routine basis to these rates, more of a COLA adjustment. The legislation provides a mean for addressing extraordinary needs. No matter how well we try to hit this, we know that there's some people it's just not going to work for. And so we want a process where we can look at the extraordinary needs when it appears that the rate methodologies are not working so we can address those. Now, since this language was drafted, we actually have been able to work with the Disability Law Center and now working with stakeholders on more specific criteria so we can put some more meat on the bones in that one compared to what's in the bill. This bill language also highlights a set of rate components that we have termed interim values, which will require further research and engagement with stakeholders. So some of this, for example, with day services, what are we going to put in around transportation? That was a really confusing area. We know that there are transportation costs being paid for, so we put a value in just to help us move forward with it. Because, again, with the budget neutrality, there's some other factors that will help mitigate it, but knowing that we probably haven't landed on the right one. As Senator Hoffman said, we've reached a lot of agreements. We are in a way different place than we were a year ago. However, there are some areas of disagreements, and I think Lynn will highlight some of those in her testimony. And as I had mentioned, despite all the work that went on, there were areas we just couldn't reach an agreement. We either didn't feel we had enough data or it just was a bigger issue than we were able to handle. And one of those is the example of the geographic differences. Strategies that have been built into this proposal, just to summarize, to try to mitigate disruption to providers and to potentially to clients. One is to create that budget neutrality factor by service area so that we're assured that residential service spending in the future is about the same as it is now or at the point of implementation. Same with day services. That we're limiting rate changes to no more than 1% up or down for an individual by creating an exception process so we can deal with some things that may arise for individuals. Using these interim values where they're labeled in the legislation to give us something to work from, knowing that we may need to make some changes, and also a process to really evaluate it and do some regular reporting. I do want to comment this proposal is budget neutral. You can't have this much variation in rates across a system that has been operating for close to 30 years to try to put in a way of managing this to bring more consistency without causing disruption. And even if we all sat here and said we agree on every single solitary component in the framework and how it works, it still is creating a change. And we know that. And that's part of our difficulty. We've really tried to work hard with stakeholders. We've had some very honest, hard conversations, and I think that we have really been able to get to a place of understanding some of the different issues there. We have a far better product because of that, of going through that. We have a shared goal for providers to be successful. We know that they need to be compensated for the services, and so people can be successfully served. We also know that Minnesota is a leader. We have been rated number one across the country for our home and community-based services. And in large part, this is because of the diversity and breadth of our providers, and we want our providers to be successful as we go on. And people depend on it in order to be able to live and work and play in our communities. So as we come here today with two different bills, we are committed to continue working with our stakeholders to reach as many agreements as we can in these next few weeks, now that they've seen all of our language and we've now had a chance to see theirs. We also are making a commitment to present information to you so that you can make decisions on these areas. So I don't know if it's necessary to walk through section by section, but I'm here to answer questions.
I think we can proceed. people have specific questions on sections, I think they'll ask them. But we have another testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Lynn Noren from RISE Services, and RISE has been around for 52 years, providing services and supports to people with disabilities. So,
thank you, Miss Noren.
Yeah. Good
Please
evening.
Introduce yourself.
Good evening, Madam Chair. As Senator Hoffman said, I'm Lynn Noren. I'm the president of RISE Incorporated, and we're an organization that provides services, housing, employment, and community-based services to over 4,000 people each year. We serve a wide geographic area covering the Twin Cities and central Minnesota, and really our services are there to provide support to people and helping them live self-determined lives. We serve nearly 800 people each day that will be impacted by these rate frameworks, and those include people with intellectual disabilities, people with brain injuries, people with mental health conditions, physical disabilities, and people who are deaf or hard of hearing. Most of the people that we serve at RISE have multiple disabilities and complex needs that we support. I've been honored to be part of the Department of Human Services Advisory Committee for this project since 2009. And I represent the Minnesota organization that supports rehabilitation and habilitation. Together with other stakeholder groups, we've logged hundreds of hours, many, many hours, working together to develop this rate framework system. And we've worked hard on the processes that are going to guide the new rate system. We've done a lot of work in a collaborative manner, and while we've made great progress, there remain a number of significant areas that continue to need to be addressed, tested, and resolved prior to implementation. One key example of the need for additional work on this project is the recent publishing of the rate frameworks on the DHS website. And the frameworks that have been recently published are the frameworks that we look at to test the methodologies. In testing the methodologies for day services, we noted that the rates are between 40 and 50% lower than current published rates today. So you can imagine how unsettling this was to the provider community without any clear resolution about how we were going to resolve that issue. We know that DHS understands there's still work to be done, and we're working to resolve that. But today we know that there are also some underlying challenges that remain to be resolved prior to the implementation of the methodologies. As Alex mentioned, a specific service example where we still have work to be done is in the area of transportation, which is one of over 30 distinct program frameworks. Transportation services are very often the link for people that we serve with their job and otherwise being able to access their community. It's a key support that the individuals that we serve depend on every day. The department is in agreement that we have not gathered enough data to set the rates accurately for transportation. However, moving forward without completing this part of the service framework will impact service delivery for people that we serve. Transportation expenses account for about 20% of the daily service rate for most providers. Under the current DHS published framework, a ride that has an average rate at RISE today of $16 for a two-way trip will be reimbursed at $7.62 for the same two-way trip on average. At RISE, we provide transportation services to over 650 people every day, primarily for people who are going to work but don't have accessible public transit options available to them. With the increases in fuel costs and maintenance for our fleet of over 80 vehicles, our costs have risen nearly 20% each of the last few years. Transportation services are already a significant loss leader in our organization under the current rate structure, and we would not be able to continue to provide these services with the currently proposed frameworks. These are there are other examples of work that's yet to be done, such as a detailed exception process for people who have extraordinary support needs, facility use expenses, geographic difference factors, and other key areas. Many of the details related to the implementation processes between lead agencies, providers, and the state have not yet been determined at this time. While we understand the department has a lot of pressure to move forward, it's clear that we've made great progress in developing this system, and we're working real hard towards implementation. implementing the system without having the necessary components worked out will cause undue challenge and hardship for all parties involved, and especially for the people that we serve. The rate system will cover services to over 37,000 Minnesotans who are supported with $1.7 billion in state and federal funds in Minnesota. Certainly, we can all understand that implementation process of such magnitude needs careful consideration and planning. We believe that getting it right is much more important than the speed of implementation. The coalition bill allows for additional time to resolve the areas that are not yet complete in the methodologies. Additionally, it gives the department time to work out the implementation processes and do the necessary training with providers and lead agencies. Most importantly, it allows time for the people we serve and the providers that serve them to understand what the rates will be moving forward and to do the necessary planning to assure the stability of the provider community. Additional time will also allow for a careful analysis of projected spending under the new frameworks to assure that the projections being made are correct. It's critical to have this time for information gathering and finalizing of the rate components so that when the system is implemented, it will meet the needs of people receiving the services. The provider community in Minnesota supports the development of individualized rates for people receiving these important services. We will continue to work with the department to complete the necessary work needed and to implement this rate system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noren. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, just a little bit of information for the committee members. The House has companion bills that are the same language and the same desire to work collaboratively to get an end result that's well. And I'm honored to have Senator Rosen is going to be part of that discussion as well. And that's I think as we move forward, we're going to keep this a very collaborative and bipartisan, and we're doing what's best for the 37,000 individuals that are in our care, some of the most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota right here. And it's almost a $2 billion project. So I'm glad to be part of this whole discussion. And the expectation from all of us is that they work together to have an end product that we can all be proud of here. So that's my desire and expectation.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Did I understand that you have inquired with CMS about whether or not the date certain is 2014 or if there's some flexibility around that, Ms. Bartolik?
Madam Chair, yes, we had a conversation today to let them know what the situation was, and we told them we needed an answer, but they did not give us an answer on the phone. They would like some time to discuss it.
And what does that mean, some time?
I told them that I needed to know within a week.
Because that's when if this passes through here, it goes to finance, that would be the next hearing in finance?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And if... And that is an answer to whether or not the 2015 or the later date in your second bill, Senator Hoffman, is something that we can continue to have a conversation about. But failure to get an agreement to that means the 2014 date is firm. Am I understanding that correctly? Ms. Bartolik?
Madam Chair, right now our corrective action does say that we will implement a rate methodology on January 2014. We actually have to eliminate county contracts, and the county contract is the mechanism for establishing a rate. So we have to link those together.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
And that's where the big discussion is, because, you know, CMS is in the future, the past history has never really given hard dates. That's why it's interesting that you need a week for them to respond back to you, and they'll say a reasonable amount of time, it seems to be the word that's used. But in discussion with the assistant commissioner as well, you know, he had mentioned that, you know, that's still room for discussion. So we will have a product ready to go in an answer to that question that you're throwing out here, Madam Chair.
In a week.
Absolutely.
And I just would hope that if there are elements of this, like transportation or geographic issues, that you've described a variety of things that are difficult to get your arms around in terms of a formula for distribution within a neutral bucket of dollars, that if the date is firm, that doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that there can't be continual conversation and adjustments to this formula?
Madam Chair, the language currently in Senate File 1315 does specify that we must continue working in any interim value. We can keep reporting back. So our intention was never that we were closing the door on it. It was just how to begin with this rate methodology to meet our corrective action plan and then continue to work.
Okay. Did you want to speak to that, Ms. Noreen, at all?
No.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is, can you describe for me what's the significance on page one when you're talking about the payment requirements? And I'm not sure who needs to answer this, but staff compensation is now included in the payment requirement methodology, and before it was staffing patterns. So I want to know what's the significance of that change, and then it looks like staffing and supervisory patterns have been combined. But what's the significance of that change? And then I have one other question, too.
Madam Chair, Ms. Bartolik did touch briefly on that on page four of her comments. So Senator Nelson, I'll let her explain
that. Ms. Bartolik?
Madam Chair,
It's this one right here, where they changed the staffing patterns. Now it's about compensation. Just saying, what is the staffing composition?
Yes. It was trying to add in that we had to do more than just look at staffing patterns. We also have to look at those factors that contribute to the payment, such as wages. The original payment methodologies, as we were going forward and trying to delete a lot of language, some of this was set up last year in how are we going to do research, and now we're past that research phase, and now we're trying to describe it more completely.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I understand the rationale for changing that. And then my second question, I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit. It's been brought up twice now that this bill currently does not take into account geographic difference factors. And so I'd like you to explain a little bit about what do you mean by that? How would it affect different parts of the state? Just elaborate on that a little bit, please.
Ms. Bartolik.
Madam Chair, I will give a very high-level overview. I wasn't actually in the committees. I don't know, Lynn, if you were. Okay. And I can have someone else come up if you want more specific. Okay. But we were looking at, because there was an assumption that there's differences in the rates across the state that were that could be attributed to different costs that had to be accounted for in that process. And my understanding was, even through going through it, for some high costs that might be in a metro area, there were other higher costs that might be there in greater Minnesota. And so in the end, it wasn't that people weren't identifying factors, but we could not. There was no agreement on whether or not how to proceed with that. And Craig can address it from the committee's viewpoint. I also have staff here if you have additional questions.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Weber. I work for ARM, but I've been an active part of the rate-setting process for quite a while and helped put together the legislation for the coalition bill. For a geographic factor, right now the frameworks don't have a specific adjustment that takes into account different costs of where you're getting where you're being served, and that was one of the areas that last year's bill directed the department and us, the stakeholders, to look at. Eventually, we looked at different options for doing that. A way that it's one area where this is done right now is in nursing homes, where we establish different regions and you get different adjustments based on those regions. And through the discussions, we looked at several ways of doing that, but we weren't able to come up with an agreement on how to define those areas and how that adjustment would be calculated. And so that's where the bill stands right now.
Senator Nelson.
That's enough. Thank you.
I think that this is very interesting to me, too. I'm very curious about what, if anything, you're able to come up with, because this concept is not only in relationship to this rate setting, but it has to do with the issue of rebasing for costs and payments to hospitals, nursing homes. How does the geographic nature of service provision impact non-emergency medical transportation services? I mean, it just is a struggle to, and we used to assume in the hospital rates, for example, that you just calculate that the wages are higher in one part of the state than another, so you pay them more than others. And we've been having this absolute problem with reimbursing based on those assumptions without ever recalculating what are the actual costs. Some are more expensive in the rural area for things that are less expensive in the cities, and some are more expensive in the cities that are less in the rural area. So how do you figure that out and calculate that into the formula? Not just for this, but for a number of formulas that we're trying to work. Local government aids is another one. So I'll be interested to see what you come up with. Good luck. Is there any other questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman, final word.
I move Senate file number 1315 to be referred to the Finance Committee in the collaborative manner that we're here tonight to show that we can get this done on behalf of everybody.
Great. Thank you. Senator Hoffman renews his motion to pass Senate file 315.
1315.
Or 1315. What did I say? 1315, and it as amended?
Yes.
And was it amended? No amendment?
No, Madam Chair.
As
no,
it is? Okay. And referred to finance. Thank you. So let me repeat that confusion. Senate file 1315 be passed and referred to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. And that means that there's not any further business to come before the committee, and we're adjourned until Wednesday during our regular meeting time.